Hello and welcome. My name is Liz Gleeson and you're listening to Shapes of Grief. Shapes of Grief is a curation of stories from international guests who share their unique experience of grief. These stories are shared with the wish that you, the listener, may find some comfort, hope and solidarity, and maybe also the realization that you're not alone in your grief. Each time you listen, please do support the podcast by donating on the website shapesofgrief.com or by becoming a patron on patreon.com. It's a privilege to hold these conversations and I extend my deepest gratitude to all my guests for showing up in this particular way. It truly is a gift. Welcome back to Shapes of Grief. I'm Liz Gleeson and delighted today to be joined by a guest from California, Christine Carlson. Christine, you're very, very welcome.
Oh, thank you, Liz. It's so nice to be here.
We've a lot to talk about today, Christine, as always. But I'm really looking forward to hearing more about your story. From what I know of you, you've really taken your grief and catalyzed it into something positive for yourself going forward in your life. But I know that that doesn't happen overnight. And I'm really curious to know how you got to where you are. But before we go there, Christine, 15 years ago, life was very different. You were living with your husband, Richard Carlson. And yes, that's a name that people probably will recognize. Yourself and Richard wrote the book, Don't Sweat the Small Stuff, which was a global success. Who was Richard? Who was the man behind this book alongside you?
Well, the first thing I always think about Richard when somebody asks me that question is that, you know, Richard would have considered himself a very ordinary man. Like, he really wasn't ordinary in the way that he lived, in the manner in which he lived, because he had an extraordinary kindness about him. When you gather a group of people and they remember and reflect on who Richard was, the prevalent theme in the room was just how incredibly kind. He really led with kindness, he led with love, and he barely ever lost his temper. Maybe he should have more, maybe he would have lived longer. You know, he really was just a really beautiful, beautiful soul, and certainly a wonderful husband, wonderful father. When he died, he was probably at the pinnacle of his success in a lot of ways, or maybe a little bit feeling on the downturn, possibly, because, you know, once you've written a book like Don't Sweat the Small Stuff, which was such a global, phenomenal book, everything after that is sort of a down, you know, it doesn't quite inch up to that level. And he was an amazing athlete, like a really top nationwide athlete as a college student. He was number 5 in the nation in tennis. He played Wimbledon. He played in the top tournaments around the world at that time in his life. And so he used to say, you know, anything short of number 1 was a downturn. And that was just something that he knew as an athlete and as being a kind of a winning person in life, you know. And when his book was number 1 on the New York Times for over 100 weeks, every week he looked at that with complete gratitude and elation, celebrating that, knowing that there would be a time when it wasn't that, and knowing that he needed to remember this time and also honor the work that he would do after, which is what he did. At the time of his death, he was promoting a book, and he got on a flight. He wasn't feeling well. And, you know, I remember saying to him, you know, you should go to the doctor. Something's not right. I feel like something's not right. And he said, you know, I really need to do this. I'm just going to push through. And that was who he was as an athlete. That's who he was as a man. I think a lot of men feel like they need to push through. Had he had a different attitude toward life, he might still be alive, you know, but he got on that flight 15 years ago he was 45 years old, and on the descent of that flight, he died from a pulmonary embolism. He was experiencing a lot of back pain from his tennis years, a lot of serious back pain. In fact, I'd say his spine was disintegrating one vertebrae at a time in his low spine. He was a large man, so he was almost 6'4" and 200 pounds. So he had a lot to deal with at the end of his life. And that loss was so sudden, because nobody thinks, you know, I wasn't thinking, I knew he was uncomfortable. I knew he was suffering. We were dealing with that. But nobody thinks you're going to die from back pain. You know what I mean? But he died from a complication from back pain, which was the inactivity that it caused him to have created the climate in his body for the deep vein thrombosis, which then led to the pulmonary embolism. And he didn't, you know, because he wasn't feeling well and didn't really acknowledge that on that flight, when you have a blood clot released from your leg on a flight like that, it's very lethal. And he really did die suddenly and very, very quickly, I believe, because nobody on the flight knew. So,
Christine, you said there, if he had gone to the doctor and hadn't pushed through, he might still be here. Were you angry with him after he died for not going to the doctor?
Of course there was, a bit of anger in that. You know, you go through so many emotional changes in grief, and I don't feel like you do stages, you don't go through one stage and then move to the next stage. I feel like it's every bit of it is every single day. And you know, some days you're just angry that this happened to your life. You know, I think one of the biggest things about grief that I discovered is that we want to go back. We want our lives to be what they were, and there is no going back. There's so much finality in death in that way that, you know, you have to reconcile that. And when you're a person who hasn't really gone through any kind of loss, like I was at that time in my life, I was 43 years old. Our sets of parents were both alive at the time. You know, I had lost a couple of friends to accidents along the way, and maybe my grandparents, but nobody really super, super close to me. So I really didn't know anything about grief. I mean, but you know, I always say everyone, there's no person in this world that isn't an expert on grief after they've gone through true loss. They become that expert.
You were rocket launched into it. You'd never experienced grief before. And then you had the sudden and untimely death of your husband. You talk about this magnificent man, you know, big in stature and big in personality. Did you always feel that before he died, when you were together, when you met him?
Yeah, I did. And when I say big in personality, he had actually a very quiet presence. He was a bit on the shy side, which always really surprised me that he rose to being such a public figure and such an amazing public speaker. But he would talk so quietly on the stage that you would see everyone lean forward to listen to him, because he wasn't a Tony Robbins kind of personality. He was a very subtle, quiet, but strong, huge presence individual. And that was what he really brought to people, was a true sense of being present. In fact, Oprah touted him on Oprah as teaching her how to live presently. Mm. So it was his thing, was to really be present and to honor this day. In fact, the right before he died, he left this poem all around our house. It was the poem that was written after 9/11, called "If Tomorrow Never Comes." And I found this poem, it's almost as if there was a part of him that subtly knew that something was gonna happen. And he left this poem, and you know, all around our house, "If Tomorrow Never Comes." And it was all about living each day as if it could be your last, and don't forget to say, "I love you." Don't forget to say goodbye, you know, because it could be the last time you ever see someone. And that was the man he was. You know, he lived that way, and he lived to his teachings. And a lot of leaders don't. A lot of leaders don't live to their teachings. But Richard Carlson, if you asked anyone who knew him, did. And I think out of all that I ever admired most about him, it was that he actually really did walk his talk. Did it mean that he never sweated the small stuff? No, he definitely did, but he was also very humble about that. And he would laugh about it, and we would laugh about it. And we'd be like always saying in our household, well, is that small stuff or is that big stuff? Oh yeah, it's all small stuff. And I, you know, that's probably the one bone I have to pick with him about the book title, is that it really isn't all small stuff. You know, there are a few things in life that really categorize themselves as a cataclysmic things, like they, and certainly loss and death are among those. Devastation from these natural disasters that we go through are among those. You know, there's some really, really big stuff that we have to just survive and live through and heal through.
Absolutely. And particularly if we look outside of, you know, Western civilization as well, there's a lot of big stuff out there, isn't there? Thinking of Afghanistan at the moment.
So much. But
Christine, to go back to your life before Richard died, 100 weeks, number one on the New York Times bestselling list, you know, meeting Oprah, like I can only imagine how exciting it was. Like the highest of the highs, in a way. Would you tell me a little bit about that time so it can help bring context to your loss?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's that illusion that we get in life sometimes that we are a bit invincible, and that is the delusional part. You know, you start to feel like you have some sense of control in life because everything that you plan eventually manifests. Now, our story was not a typical, like it wasn't an overnight success story. It took 10 years. Richard had written 10 books prior to Don't Sweat the Small Stuff becoming what it was. And so that's a long time to stay with something and to, you know, to work at something. It's usually about the right amount of time before somebody hits their stride and really does become, you know, that world success that they're looking for, or that they are hoping for, or having the impact that they deeply desire, you know? So I think that there was a part of me that really believed in Richard so deeply that I just never even thought that he could die so suddenly at such a young age. I just felt like he was so strong, you know, and he was so capable, and certainly the chronic pain that he was in was very difficult, and he had his moments. And I just remember a few months before he died, he had a really, really bad back bout with his pain. He was on his back, and I asked him, you know, what is the pain like? And he said, if you put your fingers in the door jamb and closed the door, and then had you know, a 2,000-pound elephant standing on you at the same time, that's essentially what I deal with when I'm standing up, is that kind of pain. Well, to me, that described mind-blowing kind of childbirth pain. That's how I describe going through natural childbirth. It's the kind of pain that doesn't have a beginning and doesn't have an end, and you don't even know where it's coming from. And that's what he was going through. So he said to me at that time, he didn't think that he could do this anymore. And I remember just panicking, like, what are you talking about? You can't do this anymore. And he just was like, wow, I can't live like this. And I think that in that moment, his spirit opened to what was to come literally a month and a half later.
Profound loss can rock our inner world. It's confusing, life-altering, and often scary. You've probably already figured out that there are no stages of grief. But are there other models, theories, tools, or practices that can help us to navigate the grieving process? To learn more, visit shapesofgrief.com. As Liz says, the more people who are grief-trained, the more supportive and compassionate our society will be. And that will make life so much better for anyone coping with loss and grief. Now, let's get you back to the podcast.
And you know, I do think, I believe that our spirit does open to the possibility that our life is, you know, that we've completed what we came here to do. And I certainly felt that way after he died. Suddenly I realized that that's when that happened. And there really wasn't anything I could do to stop it, even though he did get better after that. Like his body rallied and we found ways to help him get through that pain. And yet, you know, he still died like 6 weeks later. So
it's an interesting concept, isn't it, Christine, to question whether the soul knows somehow or chooses somehow when they're going to depart. One of my recent guests, Megan Scully, talks about her brother who was just 18 when he died in a car crash, but somehow that night he had left the house and he went back in and gave his mom another hug. And we often hear these stories, and you know, it's part of the mysticalness of being human, isn't it? You know, what is us making meaning of someone's loss, or what is, you know, the realm that we just don't understand? You talked about the poem All Over the House, and
yeah, I mean, I tend to err on the mystical side just because it's a lot more fun to think that life is magical and mystical. And yet, I mean, I think what's beautiful about science now is that science is proving so much of the mystical and the spiritual realms to be true. And so the scientific people can even start to realize that what is mystical and magical is actually very scientific as well. And I have a really amazing story that illustrates this, if you would like me to share.
Yeah, absolutely, would love to hear it.
So one of the things that I realized, and I shared this story in a TED talk I did, it's one of the stories I love to share because it speaks so much to just the beautiful grace that we can invoke in grief. And one of the things I learned so deeply when I was grieving was what Richard taught Oprah, which was to live very presently. And one of the reasons I feel like I learned that was grief actually put me in the practice, in a very mindful practice of being present, just simply because I realized that living in my past regrets about wanting to change what happened just simply couldn't be. And it always took me into just a deep spiral of grief to go into the regrets. And then also what would take me into a deep spiral of grief was to try and imagine my life without Richard, which I absolutely, after 25 years of being in this amazing relationship with him, could not imagine my life without Richard in it. And it was so painful. So I began to live very much in the present moment for at least the first year of grief, where I felt like I can survive, I can raise my children, I can make decisions, I can move forward in the present moment. And I still, of course, grieved. I mean, I still had my moments where I couldn't do that, because of course that's a moment-to-moment decision and a real mind practice to live presently. So, but one of the things I realized is that when you're present, you're in this amazing, it's almost as if you're in this flow and this grace holds you. And I would have so many things happen where I felt this. And so one such day, we were flying back, my girls and I, from Eugene, Oregon to San Francisco, which is a short flight. It's only about an hour flight. It's not very long. And we were on a small commuter jet, about a 50-person commuter jet. When we went up to the ticket agent, the ticket agent said to us, "Wow, it's Christmas time and you guys aren't seated together. I would really like to see you seated together. Would you like me to rearrange your seats?" And I told him it didn't matter. You know, it was a short flight. The girls were, you know, they would sit together and it didn't really matter. But he took it upon himself to rearrange our flight, our seats anyways, so that we would be seated together. And when I sat down, I was seated in the aisle and my girls were on the side of me and the window seat was open. So when the man came up that was going to sit down in the window seat, he stood before us for a moment and, you know, filled up the cabin because it's a small plane. The girls kind of laughed and giggled. And I got a chill that ran through me like this, whoa, what is this? This is a weird feeling I'm having. I got up and I let him sit down. Well, I really wanted to talk to him. And that was what it was in my head is, I really am supposed to talk to this guy. Well, he pulls his laptop out and he gets busy and clearly he doesn't want to talk because he's working. So I didn't talk to him.
So he's not in present mode at all.
No. And then he clearly was not in a social mode. He was working and I could tell. So I quieted down and try to engage him. But on the descent of the flight, when he put his laptop away, I thought, this is my opportunity. And I turned to him and I said, is this a work day for you? And he said, yeah, I'm sorry. I would have loved to have chatted, but I've got a meeting this afternoon. And then we chatted about why he was there. He was visiting his sister. I was visiting my parents. And then he said, what about you? I noticed you have your computer with you. And I said, well, technically every day is a work day. I'm a writer. So I have my computer at all times with me. And he said, oh, have you been published? And I said, well, you might be familiar with my late husband's work, Dr. Richard Carlson. He wrote Don't Sweat the Small Stuff. Well, the man visibly got upset. He sort of sat back and he just sort of like looked shocked. And I was like, what? Like, did you know him? And he goes, no, I didn't know him. I know of him. And then it was like he was holding his breath. Like he was really in a state of shock. And I said, what? And he said, well, did he die on a flight 2 years ago to landing in JFK? And I said, yes, he did. How did you know it was JFK? And he said, I was seated directly behind him on that flight. I was the first to assist the crew members when we landed. I helped lift his body out of his seat. And I burst into tears and I say, well, what are the chances of this meeting? And he said, there are no chances of this meeting. And he said, I always wanted to tell you that he died peacefully. He said, of course, I looked you up and I knew he had a family and I always wanted to tell you that. And I said, well, I always wanted to know who was on that flight with him, who held space for him on that flight because I wasn't there. And, you know, I felt a lot of guilt about that. Like I felt a lot of things about not being present for Richard when he passed on. You know, it was either, I mean, in some ways it was less traumatic for me, like in some ways it was more traumatic for me, you know, like I can't even imagine how traumatic that would have been had I been there. But it was also incredibly traumatic to not have been there. So that part
there, we make up stories, don't we? Or we have 10 or 20 different possible scenarios going around in the brain.
Absolutely. But that particular meeting really helped me heal. It was one of the deeper desires that I had 2 years after was to know and to be able to speak to somebody who was on that flight.
What was the impact like for you, Christine, of hearing that and knowing that Richard had died peacefully, that someone was with him? What did that do for you?
It just made me, first of all, the meeting this man for me was just such a pivot because I've had, like I said, many experiences where I felt very divinely guided and loved through this process, but that one was so unmistakably divine to me and so unmistakably orchestrated from the man who rearranged our seats to the, you know, I mean, I just knew and I felt so loved, you know, I felt so loved and so guided and it just helped me heal, you know, it helped my heart heal that much more to realize that Richard was okay and that I'm going to be okay too, and that I'm loved through this process, and my kids are too, were held. And it just reaffirmed to me so much that when we live that kind of presence, when we're very, very open, and our hearts are really broken open, but we choose to, you know, be in it as opposed to denying it. For me, I was really awake And that's what I mean by heartbroken open. I mean, I woke up to my life and I woke up to being present to my life. And these are the kinds of experiences I started really, I'd had many of them, but I was having in my going through my loss.
I'd love to know more about how you got there, Christine, because we know so much about our bereavement outcome depends on the meaning we make of a loss. And, you know, there isn't a given meaning to anybody's death or any loss. And sometimes it can just be empty and meaningless for some people. And then for other people, it's so, it can become so meaningful, and rarely at the time of loss or in the early days. But what is it? What do we need? Like, is it cultural? Is it societal? Is it personal? How some people can make this beautiful meaning from a loss and other people can't. I'm curious to know about your process through that. And I know that the research, I remember when I did my master's in bereavement studies, learning that people who have a faith tend to have better bereavement outcomes, because in a way you can already locate your deceased loved one with God or in heaven. Well, that's where they are. And you, there's a certain amount of meaning that's given to you. And that, you know, if you have a faith, and this can be really tricky for people who don't have a faith. Where are they now? What is it all about? So I'm curious to know about that journey for you. Were you ever desperate, despondent, feeling like you didn't want to go on or couldn't go on?
Of course. I mean, I think that for me, I feel like from the very beginning, I could see both paths through loss. I could see myself. I mean, granted, you know, I'm a little unusual in the sense that I've lived an incredibly rich psychological, I don't have a master's in psychology or a PhD, but I very well could. I mean, just I've lived a very psychologically oriented, observing life. So I'm very attuned to psychology and my own psychology, and even in a very rich spiritual life, not a traditional spiritual life, although I came from a very evangelical Christian home. I would say Richard and I were more Buddhist in our belief, Buddhist and Hindu in our belief system, combining all that the kind of the intertwining golden threads of faith and religion, mostly in how we live our lives and how we value kindness. I would say kindness was our religion, you know, and also the understanding that life continues, you know, life continues on. It's a continuation, that I had this deep awareness that the soul inhabits the body, but that the soul chooses the body for the experience of being human and being alive in the three-dimensional, four-dimensional, maybe some people get to the fifth and sixth dimensions in this body, but it's rare. You know, I think most people are here and we're living a very physical life, which is what we choose. And that when our physical life, pardon me?
Take us through the dimensions. I'm not sure I know what those six dimensions are.
Well, I'm not a dimension specialist or, you know, but from my understanding is, and my belief is that that we live in the third and fourth dimension, and that's a physical reality. And every dimension further up is a dimension where the veil gets thinner into the other realities that exist simultaneously with this one. So spiritually, I feel like the veil is very thin. And when you lose somebody that you love, if you open to the experience of loss, the veil gets even thinner. And that for me, I really simply had to know that Richard still existed. I had to know that he was still with me. I would not have been able to live. I would not have been able to continue my life with such empowerment if I felt that he was gone to me. Now, that doesn't mean that on the physical level, did I miss holding him? Did I miss speaking words with him? Did I miss laughing with him? Did I miss brushing our teeth and having it slop all over our faces together? Did I miss, you know, having coffee with him in the morning, with him right there talking to me? Yes, I missed all of that. And I dealt, and I, that was where my grief, I had to reconcile that. But then did I transcend knowing that he was still with me? I've had so many like messages from him all the time where I know he's, you know, present. And so I feel that when we are open to those things, we see those things. And this is a part of my grief and my loss that I feel was very rich. It was a very rich, fertile ground of deepening my spiritual awareness, where maybe there was anger at God. I remember I wrote, I've written a couple of books, and I wrote in one of my books that I felt like God had an Alzheimer's moment when he took Richard. Like, like, why did you take this amazing man that had so much life left to live at such an early time? You know, he was a somebody I felt who would have, the world would have benefited by having him here, you know, that much longer. But then, you know, when you say you find meaning, you know, for me, I referred so much to the teachings that Richard had even taught me, the things in our conversations that he would say. And he would say, like, before he, I mean, in October before he died, he said, you know, we're walking up a hill and he's like, Chris, you know what I love about the human spirit? And I'm like, what, honey? And he said, I love that there are people in this world that take their greatest tragedy and allow it to move them forward in life so that their lives have more meaning than they might have otherwise had. I mean, who says that kind of stuff? Richard Carlson says that kind of stuff to his wife, who's about ready to lose him. You know, and I couldn't help but reflect on those things, like the circumstances of life don't make or break you, they reveal you. You know, these are the kinds of things that popped back to me as guideposts, and they came from Richard. And so it was so fascinating that in my loss, you know, he and Cahil Gibran from The Prophet were my greatest teachers in loss, and he impacted my life. And I would hope that people realize that whenever our identity is in crisis, you know, we think of this always as a bad thing, but identity is also ego. And ego, you know, is created for certain reasons. You know, it keeps us safe in a lot of ways. There's a lot of reasons why we have an ego. But one of the things that happens in an identity crisis is your ego is at an all-time low. And I always say that when your ego is at an all-time low because it's in crisis, that's what's putting you in crisis, then your authenticity and who you really are is right there. Who you really are is right there. Yeah. And I started to realize this, that this loss had shattered the barriers around my heart that I didn't even know existed, that had come from living this, you know, life of where I thought I had control over my life, and where I thought, oh, I, you know, nothing's gonna happen to me. I mean, I used to think when I was younger, when our lives were so cherry, I used to think that God must not think I can handle very much because everything is going my way, you know? And then bam, you know, I think that's life though. And what I've come to terms with is that's what being human, being a spiritual human is. You're a spiritual being first, you're a soul, and then you inhabit a body. And this whole body thing is about being alive. It's about feeling your life. It's about feeling all sorts of things. It's about feeling joy, but it's also about understanding that this human life is about sorrow, because we do have attachments. We do love. And I mean, to the degree at which you love is to the degree at which you will grieve. And that doesn't mean that grief has a big, you know, grief can be over in a day for some people, and it doesn't mean they loved any less, or it could be over years for some people. Grief has its own path. And, you know, I mean, I just talked to a woman last night. I'm at the pedicure place, and she was actually at one of my heartbroken open circles years ago. I used to hold these circles for grieving women in my home. and her name's Louise, and she's in her 80s now, but just doesn't look a bit different than she did, you know, 10, 12 years ago. And she said, you know, I don't think I ever grieved my son's death because I was so worried about his family.
Yeah.
And I thought, I said, you must have somehow grieved his death. You just probably did it in your own way. You know, like you didn't follow the textbook, like maybe fall down. She'd lost her husband. She'd lost the love of her life. You know, that, so she'd had a lot of loss in her life. And I said to her, maybe some losses are just too hard to grieve deeply. You know, maybe you already knew that this wasn't, you know, you weren't going to be able to survive this loss if you grieved it that deeply. I don't know. But I said, I'm sure you grieved in your own way.
Yeah, some people are able to put it away, and that's how they defend against the psychic pain of it all. I'm going to go back to the dimension thing. And, you know, one of the things that we tend to do following the death of a loved one is try to find them again. Like, where are they? Where is, you know, I've said this before in the podcast, where is their essence? You know, and I hear people looking out windows, or, you know, men, a lot of the men that I've come across tend to go into the sea and almost deep enough that they could almost drown. It's this phenomenon I've come across several times. It's like they're trying to find that veil between life and death, as if somehow, you know, their child might be revealed to them again. But how you made your grief palatable and bearable for you was to imagine that Richard was still there, just not in the same dimension, just in a dimension away, where you couldn't see him. And that helps you to feel him and relocate him.
Well, I think that, you know, there's a way in which if people could continue their relationship but just realize it's changed, you know, that, you know, there's a way in which I feel like Richard's always with me because I did spend 25 years with the man. So, I mean, I kind of know what he would say, when he would say it, how he would laugh, you know, his sense of humor. And so for me, I felt that I could move forward with my life, but I couldn't move on. And I didn't want to move on. I have never wanted to move on from the beautiful life that I created with Richard. Now, I have two grown daughters and I have five grandchildren now. And I have carried on his legacy as well as establishing my own from my pain and my sorrow. I've helped other people, many, many, many people, through their loss and inspiring them and inspiring hope. And this is, I mean, I think this is kind of one of the beautiful things that Richard said, you know, when you can take your tragedy and allow it to move you forward and your life has greater meaning. I mean, I think this is one of the paths that people can take in loss. And I think it helps people to think that they don't have to think of death as an end. Whether or not that's true or not, it probably doesn't even matter. What matters is how you live this life and how you can squeeze every last bit of juice out of this life, despite the fact that we go through unimaginable and unthinkable losses, unthinkable. You know, none of us want to receive that phone call that we have lost someone we love, none of us. And yet it happens, it's devastating. It puts you on your knees. It almost destroys you. And yet we rise like the phoenix out of the ashes because we have a human spirit that has chosen life. And to choose life over and over again, despite the things that happen, I mean, I can't even think of anything more empowering than that. You know, that this is, if we can get ourselves to that place where we realize we're worthy of a great life, despite the things that happen to us, you know, and I think that's a deep level of feeling very worthy and feeling in, you know, you're not in charge of what happens, but you're in charge of how you move forward amidst circumstances that happen. That's what you have control over, is how you choose to move forward.
I love that you say, Christine, this is one path, one possible way for people, because, you know, it doesn't seem to be accessible to everybody. I was just speaking with somebody this morning about this, that at a certain point of our process, our grieving process, for some of us, it becomes clear that there's a choice, you know, that I can either lie down and be consumed by my grief and life will never, ever be the same again, or, well, life will never be the same again anyway, or I can somehow choose life. And that doesn't happen very quickly for most people. You know, that comes with time. And also people, someone said to me recently as well, I'm scared not to grieve anymore. I'm scared to let go of my grief. And does that mean I'm losing them? For some of us, our grief is the only thing that connects us to our loved ones. So somehow finding a way to be connected to them in a less harmful way or a less painful way is a good option.
I work with a lot of widows in my work. They come on retreat with me. I do some transformational work and with widows and other people, like just people who have gone through an identity crisis. And one of the things I recently said to a widow who said what you just said, she said, I just don't have the desire to live anymore. And I said, well, what if you decided that you're not just living for yourself anymore, but that by living and choosing life and carrying your husband with you, you're actually living for the both of you. And what if you could have a conversation with him right now and you faced him and you told him that because he's not here, you could not live anymore? What would he say to you? She said, well, he would say, that's a lot of pressure. You know, that's a lot of pressure and he wouldn't want that. And I said, of course he wouldn't want that. If the table was turned and you had been the one that died, what would you say to him? Wouldn't you want him to live? Like, wouldn't you just be devastated if you thought that your loss would bring him to that place? And she said, of course. And I said, well, then live, choose life, but choose it with him. Like, choose bringing him forward every single day with you. And that's how you step into your life. You don't have to leave him. You just have to learn to bring, like, how you create that bridge to him. It's like, it's up to us to create that bridge. I believe they're right here. I believe they're waiting for us to create that bridge, that it's up to us to ask and for us to continue, because we're the ones that have the barrier, you know, we're the ones that have the mental barrier against it. So I think that this is one of the ways we choose to move forward without as much pain and suffering. And you're right, it takes time, because we have to reconcile the physical part of our loss. We have to reconcile that this is a new relationship, that you can have this new relationship and it's fulfilling and it's loving and it's supportive. And you know what they would say, and you can laugh and think of them and, you know, bring them into your daily life. You know, I talk about Richard all the time with my grandchildren. You know, I'll date a new man and my grandson will say, well, just don't forget Grandpa Richard. As if I'm ever going to forget Grandpa Richard, you know? So there's this way in which, you know, you carry that person forward with you. I remember there was this one man that I dated for some time, was quite in love with him actually. And I thought that we might partner up, but it didn't happen. But at one point he said, well, I know when you die that you're going to go to Richard, but when I die, who am I going to go to? And I said, well, you'll go to Richard too.
He's got everybody's backs. And it's really interesting what we're talking about here, Christine, because it's the paradox of grief. And there are so many paradoxes in grief. To be able to get to the place of choosing life and appreciating things, it's almost the result of a broken heart. So we have to let that heart break first as well. You know, we can't just jump over the broken heart bit and get straight into the gratitude and the appreciation and the being open. And I say this for anybody listening, because many people who tune into my podcast, they're recently bereaved, you know, or someone they love has died in the last year. They're not a few years down the line. in many cases, and they're in that zone of, you know, will I ever feel like myself again? Will I ever feel joy again? Could I ever love again? Will I ever feel whole again? And it's so important to know that what's going on now in the grief, in the numbness, in the shock, in the lack of acceptance of the loss, there's a lot percolating underneath all of that. And it will happen in time, hopefully. You know, and if grief, you know, continues to cause a lot of suffering a year or 2 years or 3 years down the road, there is support available, and to get that support, but to listen out for those moments. You know, you said about finding Richard everywhere or finding messages from him. We find what we look for as well, don't we? Absolutely. You know, and if we're looking for a connection, if we're looking for love, or we're looking for reassurance, we tend to find it.
I like to think that, you know, for all of us, you know, even if you have the attitude that you're not going to be a victim to your circumstances, even if you have that attitude, you still have your days of self-pity. You know, everyone does. It's just, it's a natural part of living, is to, you know, kind of pull yourself up and fall down again. And certainly we feel, and I remember feeling the same way in grief in the early days. Like, I just thought, oh my God, this is my life now. I can't live this life. This is not for me. Like, to be this sad and to be this weary and tired and fatigued and wondering, am I ever going to live in joy again? I mean, and yet there was a part of me that, like, I remember my first wave of real grief when I really understood what I was in for. And that was, I was out and my kids were getting ready for school. It was 3 weeks after Richard died. And of course I'd cried, but I hadn't really understood what grief was until this moment. And I remember I'd gone to the car early in the morning at sunrise to get some salt out of the car, bags of salt to put in our salt water softener and our water purifier for our home. And I had never done that before. And I picked up one of the bags and it was freaking heavy. Like, I was like, this is heavy. And I was like, it was like, you know, 50 pounds. I'm like, oh crap, I don't know if I'm gonna be able to carry this. And I stepped away from the car and suddenly I realized everything that was on Richard's plate was now on my plate. Everything, all of it, the entire huge life that we had created, everything in it, all of the tasks, the everything, every physical possession we had, the website, the books, the message, the kids, you know, everything was on me now, and I was alone. And man, I'll tell you what, that bag of salt got to be 1,000 pounds. I went down on my knees and I grabbed my stomach and I started to really wail and cry. And I remember thinking the only time I ever felt this kind of contraction and this kind of pain was when I was having a child. And I said, oh my God, I am birthing. And I know that this is going to take longer than 16 hours. Like, this is grief. And, you know, and, but I began to also realize that my body really taught me. And I was one that I didn't know what it was going to take. I didn't know how long it was going to take, but I did not. I was 43. I was a young woman, very, very young woman. And I didn't want to live the rest of my life in pain and suffering. I just knew I wasn't cut out for that. But I didn't know how long it would take. And I didn't know what it would take. But I started to realize when I didn't cry enough, my stomach would hurt. And the way I would realize this is that as soon as I cried and I let it out, my stomach felt better. Yeah. It's kind of a simple process. You know, you look, your body teaches you, you know, you will, your body will show you when you're not grieving enough. And then you do the thing that releases it, however that is for you. And again, that's where we all have a latitude in how we do grief. Like, some people laugh their asses off when they're in grief. You know, some people scream, some people cry quietly, you know, whatever it is, however you do your grief and release it. But I feel that my body taught me to release grief from my body. And sometimes I would do all of those things. And I would be rewarded by a feeling of peace afterwards. Mm. And so I listen to, you know, I listen to my body. And I also, the biggest thing I did was I knew that surrender, trust, and accept was the mantra that I had to follow, because I had long lived the serenity prayer in my life. I had long lived with the idea that you have to ask yourself if you can change these circumstances. And when the answer is no, then you have to surrender. And surrender doesn't mean weakness. Surrender is a strength, because it means allow. And for me, it meant allow the divine to be in my life, allow myself to be held in grace, and allow myself to heal. And that came from learning from my body that I needed to empty out grief, that I needed to get it out of my body. That was my one guiding principle that helped me so much, was get it out of my body.
Express it. Yeah.
Yes.
Either through wailing, crying, writing, running.
All of it.
Painting.
All of it. All
whatever
of it.
Way. Yeah.
All of it.
But it needs to be engaged with, right? It needs to be expressed. And engaged with.
The other thing I did, which was quite unusual, I know a lot of people that are grief leaders, you know, counselors, grief leaders, people who have been through loss that, you know, talk about their loss. And a lot of them talk about grief as the enemy. And I actually realized that grief was my friend. And I made grief my friend, because I thought, well, as soon as you show up, I just have to have a conversation with you. I have to deal with you. And then you go away. And if I don't deal with you, you stay.
Yeah.
But you're overstaying your welcome, you know? So I would welcome in grief when it showed up, and then I would allow myself to feel it. And then I would let it go and let myself have my day, let myself be present to what was present in my life. And this was a beautiful process that I went through, where it became a practice. It became a life practice to go through those emotional turmoil feelings, to allow myself to have a beginning with it and an end with it. And then it would start all over again at a different moment in time. And I would just be like, okay, here it is again. Yeah. Okay, this is really inconvenient. It's on the soccer field. You know, my kid's playing soccer. This is super inconvenient, but I can go find a place, and I go for a walk, and I would allow myself to cry, you know? And so, you know, these are the ways in which I dealt with my grief. And I hope that they inspire other people. I've certainly worked with a lot of widows that have followed this path, and it has helped them a lot. And
from my experience, when people don't express their grief or don't roll with it, it causes tremendous suffering. And the suffering from not grieving and shutting that down or denying that part of you is far worse to being on your knees on the ground wailing, which is essentially such a beautiful release and so necessary for the body. But tell us a little bit about your book, Christine. I haven't read it. I'd love to read it. Heartbroken Open. Who is it for?
Yeah, so I wrote this book, and it was published years ago. It's really the account of my first 2 years of grief. And it's a memoir, and it's Heartbroken Open, a true story of coming alive again after profound loss. And, you know, it's a book about how I discovered myself, and I show a pathway of healing. I really actually wrote it because I realized that I had been primed to go through grief in ways that many people might not have been. You know, in our lives of, like I alluded to, I'd done a lot of personal growth work with Richard, studied a lot of alternative psychology methods with Richard. Together. And I had friends that were just so healthy and so right there for me, that really understood the grieving process and how to do it and how to use it as fertile ground for your growth and how to awaken from it. I just felt really like, okay, I can observe myself, and I did in this process. And this is it's really meant to lay out a path for somebody who has gone through devastating loss and give them hope. You know, it's a hopeful book for somebody in those early stages of grief. I wrote another book since called From Heartbreak to Wholeness, The Hero's Path to Joy. And that's more my how to do grief and how to really reframe your story into the hero's journey. And that came 10 years after grief. So that was a different, you know, that's after gratitude came. And gratitude for me didn't come early. You know, I wasn't grateful for this great love in the beginning that I had with Richard. I was devastated and I was annihilated. So it took me many years to return to gratitude. But once I went from grief to gratitude, I had felt that, okay, I'm in a place now where I could actually lay out a framework and a path for people that I feel really will help them. And Heartbroken Open is not that. It's really meant to be, you're in my head, you're in my heart, you're in my soul. And many people read this book in like 8 hours because it's just so raw and it's so real and vulnerable. And many widows and many people in loss write to me and say that this book was their first touchstone to how to go through grief and loss. So yeah, so I'm so super excited about bringing this book out again. It's I have a Lifetime movie coming out, which is based on Heartbroken Open. Even though it's called Don't Sweat the Small Stuff, the Christine Carlson story, they really did buy the life rights to Heartbroken Open. And so they didn't put a lot of the spiritual stuff that's in this book on the movie or anything like that. It's a very, you know, it's a fictional based on story, but I think that they did an amazing job capturing the essence of the messiness that a family goes through in loss. And also I think they courageously showed some of my more courageous moments in grief. They certainly, you know, I think television is really interesting because they're afraid to show grief as it is because they don't want a movie that's super sad. Like you hear that over and over again when you're going through this process with them. I'm like, you need to show me grieving a lot more. Like I went through a lot of grief and this is not a good example of somebody going through loss, you know, like if you don't show loss. And they're like, yeah, but we don't want a super sad movie, you know? And yet I think that they did bend and they showed enough. And I think Heather Locklear, who is playing me in the movie, did a beautiful job of really fighting for that. Like she did it, you know, she knew she had a certain amount of control. And I think she wanted to portray this, portray me more as I am and less as I was written. And I love that about her. I mean, she is a really, really wonderful human and super, super kind-hearted woman. And I just fell in love with her when I met her and spent time with her. And I think you will too in this movie. It's I think they did a really, really beautiful job with this movie. And again, it's based on my book, Heartbroken Open, which I'm really proud of. Because an author, you know, it's a pinnacle moment when you have a large network like that buy your rights for a movie. So it's a really high pinnacle for me in my career, even though I'm probably not, you know, going to get as much credit for it or whatever. It doesn't matter to me. It's just the impact of the story, is going to have a much higher a level of audience watching it. And I'm just really feel very honored at this level.
What would Richard think, Christine?
Well, recently I had a reading with a medium and she knew nothing about me or my daughter. It was my daughter actually that had the reading first. And her name isn't even our last name for you skeptics. So she suddenly just said, oh my God, he's talking about a movie. What is he talking about? A movie. And he's so excited about it. He's so excited about this movie happening. So, you know, he's very, very excited about it. Heather's been very cute about like being in touch. Like she feels like she talks to Richard all the time. In this reading, he made the comment through this medium that Heather is the perfect person to play Chris. And he said, want Heather to know I'm hearing her, want Heather to know I've been sending her signs, and that that I just love her for this role. So it's really quite profound. Like, and I know, you know, there's a lot of skeptics about mediums and so forth. I don't do a lot of that, but because I feel like I have such direct contact with Richard. In fact, that's the first thing he says to the medium. He always says, you know, Chris doesn't need you for this. She's always, she really doesn't, but this will be validating to her nonetheless. So.
So you've really found a way to keep him close, Chris.
He is close.
Yeah.
I do.
Well, I wish you so well with the republication of your book. And in this podcast description, I'll put a link where people can purchase it. And I'm dying to see the movie and what they do.
Yay. Thank you. Yeah. I think it's going to be fun.
Great. Well, you said you're going to come back to Ireland someday, so please do look me up.
I absolutely will.
And it's been such a joy to speak with you. So thank you so much for your time and best of luck with all your projects.
And thank you so much for your beautiful work for the world. And this is such a hope-filled, you have such an amazing energy about you too. So, you know, you're beautiful and you're just open. And thank you so much for being a wonderful podcast host.
Oh, thanks, Christine.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Shapes of Grief. This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical or psychological advice. And if your grief is making you unwell, please do see your healthcare provider. Once again, please consider supporting the podcast by donating on shapesofgrief.com or becoming a patron on patreon.com. I rely on your support to keep going. The music is performed by Baka Beyond, especially for the Shapes of Grief podcast. Until the next time, from Miles Gleason, take really good care. She has come down to condemn.
absolutely gorgeous.